So the title for today's talk is Venerable Sariputta, the Disciple of the Buddha. But one of the strange things about Dhamma talks is that although they have different titles, they're all about exactly the same thing, pretty much, with slight variations. Just a warning, yes, you know that this is going to be it's a Dhamma talk, basically. Yeah. So, but sometimes it's interesting. If you have a slight variation in the theme and the topic, it actually means you approach the subject from a slightly different angle. So although it may seem the same, actually sometimes it adds to the kind of the view of things, right? It sort of expands the horizons, which is the good thing about it. So, Venerable Sariputta, it so happens that he is also one of my favorite disciples of the Buddha, probably my favorite disciple. And the reason why I like Venerable Sariputta so much is because he was the chief disciple in wisdom. And for me, wisdom is like the number one spiritual quality. When I think about wisdom, I always feel very inspired. Wisdom is the thing which makes you understand the world, understand yourself, understand people. And of course, if you start to understand how things work, what the world is like, then you can act in an appropriate way. You can act in a way that actually accords with how the world works. In particular, if you understand the mind and if you understand human beings, it means that you understand psychology, what makes you happy, what makes you unhappy, the causality of these things. So wisdom is the thing that actually makes the world function better, which makes us move in the right direction, which gives us a sense of purpose and happiness and a reduction in suffering. And that's why it is so important. It's the overarching principle in Buddhism, the one which supports everything else. And that is, the power of wisdom, basically. And that's why I'm so inspired by it. And I always think of myself, well, if there's one quality I'd like to really have, it's wisdom. Is that how you feel as well? Isn't that a beautiful quality to be wiser? Yeah. So that is why I like Venerable Sariputta so much. But before I go on to tell a few stories about his wisdom and what he was like, first of all, I just want to look a little bit about his background and how he actually came to become a Buddhist monk. There was a lady here a couple of days ago who gave a talk about Venerable Sariputta. Is she here today? I'm not sure if he's today here. Okay, so I'm going to rip off a few of her stories to make it easy for myself. Actually, it's the same story. I know the stories already. I'm not really ripping it off, but it's the same stories. And one of the story of Venerable Sariputta, how he became a monk. Venerable Sariputta, he was a samana, an ascetic in ancient India, before he actually met Buddhism. And he was an ascetic with a teacher called Sanjaya Belatiputta. And he was one of the famous kind of teachers at that time. And this Sanjaya Belatiputta, he was what they call a skeptic. It means that he didn't have any position on anything. So when people asked him, do you believe in rebirth? He would say, I don't say I believe in rebirth, nor do I say I don't believe in rebirth, nor do I say I neither believe in rebirth and believe in rebirth, nor do I say that I both believe in rebirth and not non-rebirth, nor do I say this, nor do I say otherwise. And that's how he would go on, basically. So he was like a skeptic. He didn't have any position on anything. And of course, being a skeptic is not such a bad start, because if you are a skeptic, it means that you're open to external impressions, right? You haven't got a fixed position. You don't say, this is the way things are, everything else is false. You have openness of mind. So Venerable Sariputta, he was a disciple of the skeptic. And then one day, while he was walking in the city, he saw somebody who was like very restrained and who seemed very together, right? Somebody who inspired confidence in him right there and then. And this person who inspired confidence in him was a monk called Venerable Asaji, who was one of the first five disciples of the Buddha. But there straight away you see something very interesting. The interesting thing here is that if you see somebody who inspires confidence, it gives rise to confidence, right? External appearance matters. And we judge often internal spiritual qualities on external appearance. And it makes sense, because if somebody is consistently peaceful and consistently kind, well, it's got to come from somewhere, right? It comes from the mind. It's not something that just happens by accident or by random. And even if you sort of try and grit your teeth and hold it together, you can only hold it together for so long. And after a while, the person gets showed up. Actually, they are more like a fraud than the real thing. So this is how we see that there is something worthy of our respect or worthy of our attention when we see something beautiful. So Venerable Sariputta says to Venerable Asaji, you know, okay, he goes up to him and says, you know, you look very inspiring, you know, who is your teacher here? And what does your teacher teach? And Venerable Asaji, and this is another inspiring thing, he says, oh, my teacher is the Buddha, you know, the Master Gautama, or how would he say, the Blessed One, or something like that. But I'm just new to this Dhamma, so I can't really tell you at any length what this, you know, what this teaching is all about. He was an arahant, right? You can see how humble you are. You're an arahant. You know the Dhamma from direct experience, exactly what it's all about. And yet you say, well, I don't really know so much about this teaching. It's interesting how that works. So very, and this is the beauty of it, you know. If you're an arahant, you are humble. You are very kind of, you know, there's nothing to prove. There's no self there that you have to sort of support or prove who you are or anything like that. Well, never mind, just give me, you know, one sentence or whatever here. And then he says, what does he say again now? He says something to the effect that the great ascetic teaches those things that have arisen from a cause, and he also teaches their cessation. Right? Got that? Okay. Are you clear about that? So the great ascetic is the Buddha. So the great ascetic teaches those things that arise from a cause, and he also teaches their cessation. Is that clear? Okay, what happens when you hear that? Does anything happen? Thank you so much. Yeah. Okay, what happened to Venerable Sariputta when he heard that? He became a stream entry when he heard that. That's why I asked you, what happened when you heard that? Hear this teaching. It's amazing, isn't it? It's a very simple teaching. It's two lines long. And because he was so ripe and so ready, and because his samadhi was so good and everything was ready, he became a stream entry at that point. That shows you. And this is why he then later on became like the chief disciple who was the, you know, the one with the most wisdom, because he was able to grasp the Dhamma that easily. It's pretty astonishing, isn't it? I remember when I read that first time, I thought, okay, that's interesting, and then nothing happened, right? But here is this person. So I find that very, it's inspiring that somebody can be that kind of ready to hear the Dhamma, so to speak. And then, of course, once he became a stream entry, he went back to his friend, who was Venerable Mahamoggallana, who was also a disciple of Sanjaya Bhilatiputta, and he told him the same thing, and he also became a stream entry. And then they both went to the Buddha and said, you know, please, we would like to go forth in this Dhamma discipline, and they become monks under the Buddha. And it was also quite funny how that story goes, because once they had decided they wanted to become monks under the Buddha, they went to their teacher, Sanjaya, and they said to their teacher, oh, Venerable Sir, we would like to become monks under the Buddha. And then Sanjaya, you think sometimes your teacher would try to hold you back, but he said, oh, no, that's a good teaching, you know, please go forth in that one. And then Venerable Sariputta said, well, why don't you come with us and become monk with us under the Buddha? And he said, no, I can't do that. I'm so attached to the fame now of being famous and things, I cannot go forth. That's what he's supposed to have said. You know, it's kind of delightful. It's very honest, right? It's very kind of straight to the point. So that's what happened. And they went forth, they become monks, and soon afterwards they become arahats, and he became an arahat under the Buddha. So that was how he started his monastic career. Things happened very fast with someone who was so wise as the Venerable Sariputta. And then some of the other incidents of his life which might be worth mentioning before I go on to some of his teachings. First of all, he was, as I said, he was the wisest person next to the Buddha. And when the Buddha said that if there's one other monk, one other monastic in our tradition who is able to keep rolling the wheel of the Dhamma that I have set forth, then that monk is Venerable Sariputta. And that means that basically he was almost putting Venerable Sariputta on the same level as himself. He can keep rolling the same wheel of Dhamma I can keep rolling, you know. It's almost the same kind of wisdom, which is quite amazing. And if you look at some of the suttas that Venerable Sariputta taught, very often you find that they're very profound suttas. Their suttas are very analytical, and sometimes they are quite different also from the way the Buddha taught. They kind of add to what the Buddha taught. Suttas like the Samaditti Sutta you find in the Majjhima Nikaya, the somebody is, sorry, I should say this in English, otherwise you don't understand. It's the right sutta on right view, Samaditti, right? There's a sutta called the longer sutta on the elephant's footprint, also in the Majjhimanikaya, Topa Venerable Sariputta. And many suttas like that, which are very kind of detailed and analytic in their nature. And that was kind of his expertise, being very analytical and very wise about things. And for this reason, it also very often Venerable Sariputta is closely connected to the Abhidhamma tradition. So, of course, and you can see why that is the case, the Abhidhamma is very analytical. So when later generations wanted to make the Abhidhamma look very important, then they said, oh, Venerable Sariputta, he was the one who sort of got the ball rolling with the Abhidhamma. Then the Abhidhamma looks much more important. But of course, from the viewpoint of modern scholarship, the Abhidhamma is not actually from that time at all. It is from a later time. So this is more like mythology than reality, that the Sariputta was part of the Abhidhamma tradition. Anyway, it just shows you that he was regarded very highly, right? That's the main point I'm trying to make. Otherwise, they wouldn't have put him in that position. So he was, in this way, considered very wise and very exceptional. But the interesting thing is that he also had other qualities. And one of the qualities he had was he was a very humble monk at the same time. As I said before, humility and attainments on the spiritual path, they often go together. And there's this one story where Venerable Sariputta was going to walk out on alms round, and his robe was a little bit out of kilter, it wasn't quite straight or whatever, and a novice comes up to him. You can imagine a novice, like this kind of this 10-year-old or 12-year-old or something like that, this young boy, basically. And Venerable Sariputta is this arahant, maybe he's 50 years old, arahant, and this young boy or 12 years old. And this young boy goes up to him and says, Venerable, your robe is out of, you must do something with your robe isn't right. It takes some nerve, right, to do that. That's what he does. So he goes up, and then Venerable Sariputta, he has a look at his robe. Oh yes, you're right. So he goes behind the bush, fixes up his robe, and comes out afterwards. And then he says, "Thank you, teacher. Thank you, teacher." He says to this 12-year-old novice, isn't that quite beautiful? That this is the arahant, how the arahants act. It's difficult enough, it's difficult for anybody to do that sort of thing. But this is how the arahants actually act. A lot of humility, no ego. There's nothing there to defend, right? Who is this 12-year-old to tell me? It doesn't work like that. It's fine. Anybody can teach you if they're saying the right thing, and that's the main point here. And then, of course, the other thing about Venerable Sariputta was that he was a master of meditation. He had very, very deep meditation, and it is said in the suttas that whatever attainment he wanted to dwell in at any time, he could just enter it just like that. And there again, you can see the words jhanas or formless attainments or complete cessation or anything else. He could enter it at any time of the day whenever he wanted to. And again, you can see the closeness there between wisdom and samadhi. Samadhi is like deep meditation, right? Wisdom and samadhi always goes together. They always go together. And again, you can see that also in Venerable Sariputta. He had this incredible ability in samadhi practice, but he didn't have any psychic powers. And this is the other interesting thing about him. This again, it shows you what is really important in Buddhism. It's not flying through the air or going into the earth or reading other people's minds. And these things are marvelous things and very interesting. If you saw it, you'd be very excited, of course. But this is not what it's really about. And it shows you the chief disciple in wisdom. He didn't have any psychic powers whatsoever. And this is this other story about Venerable Sariputta, which shows that very clearly. He and Venerable Mahamoggallana, they were sitting in meditation together. And while they were sitting in meditation, this yakka comes. A yakka is like a demon, is somebody who they can be very nasty. And this yakka comes and it wields this enormous club in its hands. And it's about to club Venerable Sariputta on the head. And then Venerable Mahamoggallana is there, and of course he's very famous for his psychic powers. And he says to this yakka, "I wouldn't do that if I were you, because this is an arahant. You're going to get some serious bad karma if you whack him over the head with a big club." But this yakka, being a yakka, he didn't take any notice. So he kind of whacked with this enormous club, whacked Sariputta in the head. And then, as soon as he had done that, of course, the result of the bad karma meant that he went to a bad destination very quickly. But the interesting thing, after Venerable Sariputta comes out of his meditation, Mahamoggallana asks him, "Well, Sariputta, do you feel anything? You know, how is your head?" "I got a little bit of an ache just here," he says. And then Mahamoggallana says, "Well, that is marvelous, that's amazing. This yakka just whacked you over the head with a club that would have been large enough to kill a large elephant." That's what he said. "And all you feel is a little bit of a pain in the on the head." And then Sariputta says, "Well, you know, that is not so amazing. It's even more amazing that you can even see these beings, because I cannot even see a mud goblin," or something like that. That's what he says. So again, he had no psychic powers, but the power of his meditation was very profound and very powerful. So these are some of the stories of Venerable Sariputta, and there are many more to be found. Now, one thing I should say before I go on to actually talk about one of his teachings in particular, is that you should always remember that when it comes to the Buddhist teachings, that the teaching of the Buddha himself is always primary. It always comes first. There's an interesting sutta where the Buddha says that in a future time there will be a time when people listen to all kinds of teaching from everybody else, you know, from people outside Buddhism, from disciples, from everybody else, but they won't be listening to the profound teachings of the Tathagata, of the Buddha. And if we take that quite literally, it means that even the teachings of Sariputta are secondary. Come second after the teachings of the Buddha. They are not the primary teachings, right? That's what it means. If you're going to take that to its limit, that's what it means. So I think that in the case where there is a disagreement, say between a teaching given by Sariputta and the Buddha's teaching must come first. But having said that, if there's any teachings apart from those of the Buddha in the Pali Canon, you can rely on the most. It is precisely the teachings of Sariputta, because the way that he actually was praised by the Buddha, put up basically on the same level as the Buddha himself. So, I'll just have some of this tea that came in here before I go on. Okay, so now I want to talk a little bit about the teachings given by Venerable Sariputta, because if his teachings are so profound, it's probably interesting to have a look at them, right, to see what he actually taught. There it is again, okay. And the teaching that I have in mind is a teaching which may seem a bit cryptic to you at first, but I want to explain this and show you how it actually works. And this teaching is, there's a man who came to Venerable Sariputta, and he said to Venerable Sariputta, "Why is it that some beings attain enlightenment and some don't?" Right? Why is it that some beings attain enlightenment and some don't? That's a very interesting question, isn't it? If we know that, this is like the key to practicing the spiritual path to its very end. It's an interesting question. So why is that? And then Venerable Sariputta says, well, the reason is that a person who does not attain enlightenment is somebody who does not understand those perceptions that lead to decline as perceptions that lead to decline. He does not understand those perceptions that lead to stability as being perceptions that lead to stability. He does not understand perceptions that lead to improvement or increase as perceptions that lead to increase. He does not understand perceptions that lead to distinction, visesa in Pali, as perceptions that lead to distinction. He does not understand perceptions that lead to penetration to the truth, as perceptions that lead to penetration. But the person who does reach awakening or enlightenment is a person who understands these things. He understands the perceptions that lead to decline, perceptions that lead to stability, perceptions that lead to improvement, perceptions that lead to distinction, and perceptions that lead to penetration of the truth. So that is why some beings become enlightened and some don't. That's quite interesting, isn't it? It's not kind of obvious what that means. I remember when I first read that, I thought, I sort of scratched my head and I thought, what does this actually mean? Sometimes it's good to get a teaching like that, where you have to scratch your head a little bit, because it sort of makes you think in slightly new ways. What is actually going on here? What is this about perceptions that lead to all these various things? Now, the first thing to be able to understand what this means is to understand a little bit about what we mean by perception in Buddhism, right? Perception is one of the five khandhas. You have the Vedana, which is like the feelings or the sensations. You have the body, you have consciousness, and Sankhara, which is like the will. And then you have perception. So what is perception? And perception is basically the way that we experience the world. That's what perception is. So we experience the world in many different ways. So in the most basic sense, perception is like when you see something, you see a color, right? You're able to distinguish between red and blue and yellow. So how come you can do that, make that distinction? It's perception. You perceive different things in this way. And any kind of visual impact you have in your eye, the reason why you're able to recognize what's going on is because of perception. Perception perceives. Perception recognizes. It understands what is going on. That's what perception is. When you hear, it's the same thing. You know, first of all, you perceive that there is a sound. That is one type of perception. The second thing is to actually make sense of that sound. What is it? If it's speech, you have to make sense of the content of the speech. You can see how much is actually going on there. And it's a lot that our poor brains have to, you know, deal with when things come in through our ears or through our eyes or whatever. And the same thing with the other five senses, the body, the tongue, and the nose, when you smell things. All of that is perceptions that are happening here. And of course, perceptions get more complex. That's just the basic perception, the immediate impact that the senses have on our mind. But then there are other perceptions, and these are the more complicated perceptions. So you have things like, you know, one very important perception is our relationship to other people, who are our friends, who are our enemies, who are our family members, who are, you know, all the relationships we have with other people. These are perceptions that we have. It's perceptions of people and relationships in the world. And with everything that we do, we have perceptions about, you know, governments, about studies, about different kind of topics that we know about. Everything we know, everything that has come to us in one way or another is like a perception inside our minds. Almost our entire experience is like built up of perception. So perception is this very important thing through which we make sense of the world. Without perception, you cannot make sense of the world. So very broad category of these five, in these five khandhas. So that is the first thing. So that is roughly what perception is like. Now, the reason why this is important is because perception is essentially at the root of many things or how we deal with the world, right? So if you perceive things in a certain way, then it gives rise to certain emotions. Now, one of the things that we want to do in Buddhism is we want to purify emotions. We want to reduce the anger and have more metta, more compassion. We want to have more equanimity and less kind of discontent. We want to have less problematic emotions and more happy emotions. That's one of the things. So this is, of course, a very important part of Buddhist practice, to purify yourself in this way. And at the root of those emotions is always perceptions. So because of that, it becomes very important. Now we can start to see what Venerable Sariputta is talking about here, about perceptions being so important. So that's the first step. That tells you roughly what perceptions are. The second thing is, the important point here is that perceptions are malleable. They're always changing. If you think about how you're looking at the world and how you're thinking about other people, for example, one day somebody is your friend, the next day they might be neutral person, no longer your friend, and eventually they might be your enemy, right? Your perception of that person is changing. And if you look into your mind, you will see that all of your perceptions are continuously changing. There's always changes going on in there. And one of the dangers is often to actually take these perceptions as permanent. And this is what happens sometimes. You know, people sometimes, when they become very happy, they think, yeah, I found the secret to happiness. And they go off and they enjoy themselves and they mess around, do all kind of crazy things. And one day, they are no longer happy. So they thought, in a sense, that they had understood the perception that lead to happiness, that now it is kind of permanent in me, I don't have to worry about it anymore, I figured it all out, now I am, you know, I know what happiness is. So that's why in Buddhists, as Buddhists, we think, okay, I may be happy now, but who knows if it will last, it may go down again. And then we're a bit more careful to look after our happiness in a wise way, and not getting carried away by these things. Or if you get depressed, it's the same thing. Why is it that some people commit suicide when they get very sad or depressed? It's again this illusion of permanence in perception. You think that the perception I have now will last, and you're not able to see the changeability, malleability in this. So it changes. What does it mean that it changes? What it means, and this is the whole point of what Venerable Sariputta is talking about, what it actually means is that you can direct your perceptions. You can choose which perceptions you want and which you don't want. That is the whole point here. This is the whole point of these teachings. You can choose how you want to perceive the world. Of course, that choice is not just a matter of snapping your fingers and saying, now I will have metta towards everyone, right? You all know that it doesn't work like that. That would have been very nice, but unfortunately it isn't that easy. So we can choose, but the choice happens through development. You have to develop your perceptions. Everything on the spiritual path, unfortunately, requires sometimes hard work, it requires persistence, it requires that you actually do these things. But it's not really difficult. It's not, you don't have to be ultra intelligent or, you know, have a PhD or anything to practice a spiritual path. It's not so much that. It's more that you have to apply yourself persistently, and you have to try. And then, you know, even if you don't have to be incredibly intelligent, then you can go ahead and you can make enormous progress on that basis in the spiritual path. But this is the clue. The clue is we can develop our perceptions. We can actually change. And we can start to look at the world in a new way. People who used to be enemies suddenly become friends. People who were who you didn't really understand, suddenly you start to understand and you have compassion for them instead. And things start to turn around. Your perceptions are changing. So the first one of these things that Venerable Sariputta was mentioning was the understanding, the perceptions that lead to decline as perceptions that lead to decline. So what are perceptions that lead to decline? Well, if you see something, if you perceive something that gives rise to anger in you or to hatred or to negativity or whatever, that is a perception that leads to decline, right? Why do you get angry? Why do you get irritated by somebody? Why do you get negative? And if you look into the situation clearly, you see that the reason why you get angry is always because you're focusing on something which you don't like. There's something in that person which you, some character trait, it's called the patiga sanya in Pali. Patiga means like something which is almost like a bit repulsive in that person, some like a resistance that you have to that person. So that is what you're focusing on. So if you focus on like the faults in that person, the things which are not beautiful, that is when irritation, negativity, anger, all these kind of things start to arise. So that is the perception. The perception is what you are focusing on, which then gives rise to the negative thing here. So that's how anger comes about. And I say, too, for most people, if you can work just with overcoming anger, negativity, irritation, wow, you're already doing an immense job in your spiritual practice. So that, I think, for most people in lay life, as monastics, you also have to focus a bit on sensuality because it can become difficult otherwise as a monastic. But in lay life, the most important thing to focus on is the anger aspect of things, the negativity, the irritation. So what you do then is that you remind yourself. This is another teaching actually by Venerable Sariputta. This is a teaching I was taught this recently at a retreat in Batam Island a few days ago. And this is a teaching of found in the Anguttara Nikaya, where Venerable Sariputta says that it talks about five ways of overcoming anger or resistance or negativity towards another person. And those ways, first of all, they revolve around, well, if the person has a negative trait, most people also have positive traits, right? So you start focusing on the positive aspect in a person instead. And we all know how difficult that can be, right? If you really don't like somebody, oh, it's so hard to see the positive in that person. It's so difficult. We don't want to see it. We have decided this person is bad, end of story. We don't want to see the good sides. You know what I mean? It's so difficult. But then you actually have to try. And if you try, then actually you think, actually it does have good. This person does have good qualities. It's amazing. They are there. And then as you focus on those good qualities more and more, and then you try to keep your attention away from the negative qualities. Okay, let me forget about the negative qualities for a while. You put those to one side. Sometimes they kind of intrude, because that's what the negative impressions often do. They intrude into your consciousness. And you say, okay, positive perceptions. And then what you find if you do that, but again, this takes time, right? This doesn't happen overnight. But as you do that, your perception of that person starts to change. And over time, over the weeks, over the months, even over the years, somebody who you found very difficult, suddenly you have a completely different perception of that person. So this is what it means to develop and change your perceptions. You focus in a new way. You look at different aspects. You look at things in a new way. And suddenly, one day, you find that you have changed as a person. You are no longer do you have the same perceptions as you had before. Okay, what about the person then? I'm sure many of you think, what about the person who really is impossible? The person who is, you know, there really is nothing to see there, which is beautiful. And sometimes in life you come across people who can seem, you know, very bad or very naughty or very dodgy or in many different ways. And it can be very hard to see the good qualities in that person. And what Venerable Sariputta, because we're talking about him, what he said you should do in that case, you should remember, you should have compassion for a person like that. Because you know that if he really is as bad as you think he is or she is, then you know that they will go eventually, they will have to reap the result of that karma, and they will go to a bad destination. And then when you understand that they are actually sowing and making so much trouble for themselves, then of course you have compassion rather than feeling angry about them. And Venerable Sariputta gave a beautiful simile at this point. He says, it is as if you see someone and they are walking and they are far away in the wilderness somewhere. The nearest town behind them is a long way away. The nearest town in front of them is also far away. And they are sick at the same time, gravely ill. They have no medicine, they have no food, they have no water. They have nobody to look after them. They are like lost. And when you see a person like that, how would you feel? You would feel a sense of compassion, right? If you were there, you would want to help them. You know, somebody who's really sick and there's nothing they can do, and you know that they will die if you don't do something. Usually compassion would arise, unless you were in a really bad mood perhaps, but usually compassion would arise and you would say, okay, I'm going to help this person. And it's in exactly the same way, a person who doesn't have any good qualities and does all kind of bad things. It's like somebody who is really sick and who is moving towards a very bad destination, towards death, towards tremendous suffering in the future. And when you do that, when you take the focus away from the suffering that they are causing you, perhaps, and you realize that the suffering they're causing for themselves is much, much worse. That is the real problem. The little thing they're causing you is nothing compared to what they're causing for themselves. Then you can have a sense of compassion for this person. So this is how you change your perceptions around. And then the last category that Venerable Sariputta talked about is the category of the person who actually does have all kind of good qualities, right? And then sometimes you get upset even with those people. This is the nature of the human mind. We find fault with anything sometimes. So then what you have to do is you just have to keep reminding yourself and looking at those good qualities and not allowing yourself to be led astray here. Because when you see somebody who really does have many wonderful qualities, that is actually the kind of person who does give rise to the sort of confidence that makes you believe in the Buddha's teachings, that make you practice the path properly. So there's an incredible amount to be learned from somebody who really does inspire confidence in you. Like meeting the Buddha, you know, it's kind of mind-blowing if you are ready. I mean, you have to be ready to some extent, but if you are ready and you meet somewhere like that, it's like, ooh, okay, this is something completely different. And you get very inspired from that. So that is basically showing you what it means to understand those perceptions that lead to decline and to know what that actually means. It means that when you see something inside of yourself that leads to decline, you do the work that is required to change that perception so you don't allow yourself to be dragged down by negative mind states. So then briefly, before I finish off, I'm going to talk us a little bit about the other perceptions as well. Then there's the perceptions that lead to stability. And the perception that leads to stability is like your normal mind state, right? What is your normal mind state? Well, whatever that is, that will roughly mean that you stay stable where you are now. Then there's the perception that leads to increase or to improvement in yourself. And that is like, you know, beautiful mind state that you sometimes have, you know, a sense of compassion and kindness and these kind of things. And this, again, is about like developing metta, right? Developing metta is developing a beautiful view of other people. If anger is based on seeing the faults, metta is based on seeing the beauty in others. So it's just like I was mentioning before, when you focus on the negative things, so you learn to focus on the positive in people instead. And when you see the positive in people, then metta becomes possible. It's impossible to, you know, to say to somebody, may you be well and happy if you hate them. You can't do that. It just cannot be done. So if you want it to be real metta, metta which comes from the heart, metta which is sincere, not just kind of thinking and saying things just for the sake of it, you have to make it come from the heart. If you're going to have to make it come from the heart, you have to feel that the person you're saying to is worthy of that metta. For them to be worthy, you have to see the good aspects in them. It's again changing your perception. So reflect on that. You know, how can you see the beauty in the people, in somebody you want to have metta towards? And then you can start having metta. And you can say, may you be well and happy. And you actually mean it. It's not just some superficial thing. It actually comes from your heart. And that is when the feeling of metta arises. People often tell me how difficult it is to get the feeling of metta to arise. And it's true. For most people, it is very hard. But that is essentially how it happens. And then you have the perception that lead to distinction, visesa. And distinction in Pali are the kind of the very high states of mind, the deep states of samadhi, the deep states of insight. That is what is the meaning of distinction. And so this is like when you start to meditate and you sit down, you start to feel peaceful, and perhaps the joy starts to arise in you. Now that joy that comes from meditation, that comes from peace, that comes from a sense of being content with the present moment as it actually is, that joy is the kind of joy which leads to samadhi. So that is part of that visesa, part of the distinction. It's an aspect of this distinction that we're talking about. So when you feel that joy, you know that now I'm on the right track. This is heading in the right direction. This is taking me towards samadhi, towards deep meditation practice. And of course, then the joy becomes deeper. You start to feel tranquil. You start to feel a sense of happiness. And eventually you do attain a deep state of samadhi. And all of these things are part of this perception that leads to distinction. The perception of joy, the perception of tranquility, the perception of happiness, the perception of a unified mind. This is all part of that. And then lastly, the last type of perception, this is the perceptions that lead to penetration to the truth. And these are the kind of perceptions that have to do with seeing non-self, seeing impermanence and seeing the full nature of suffering. These are the things that lead to penetration to the truth. So when you investigate your body and mind and you actually see that it's just this kind of flux, always changing thing, that is the perception that eventually leads to penetration of the truth. Now that is very profound. It goes very, very deep. But it's good to sort of keep it at the back of your mind so you know where you're kind of heading for the future. But most of the work for us is always to be done on the preliminary things. For the vast majority of people, it is the preliminary things that you have to work on. And if you do the work on the preliminary things, what a wonderful thing that actually starts to happen if you do that. The rest of the path sort of starts to happen by itself. You don't actually have to do that much. If you work really hard on your virtue, on perceiving things in the right way, on having a sense of compassion and metta, it's like the path takes off and it goes by its own kind of, it's propelled by itself, so to speak. And that is the nature of how this path actually functions. So, there you are. Excuse me. That is the teaching, one of the teachings from Venerable Sariputta. So please keep in mind which perceptions lead to decline, which lead to stability, which lead to improvement, and which to distinction, and which to penetration. Particularly keep in mind the ones that lead to decline and the ones that lead upwards to improvement. If you remember those, then you have a chance of changing your perception, developing new ones, moving in the right way, and then you're on the right track. So that is the, as I understand it, is the meaning of this teaching given by Venerable Sariputta. I'm sure a lot more could be said about this teaching, but I think it is at least roughly on the right track as to what the meaning is. So that is all I want to say for to this morning's Dhamma talk. Yeah. So should we have some Q&A perhaps, if anybody want to ask any questions or anything here?
Anyone have any question? Just raise your hand.
Lightning talk. No trick question here. Just a question and a comment. Just now you mentioned about this metta, and sometimes it's very difficult to extend metta to people that you don't quite like. You know, may you be well and happy. I think you have heard somebody tell you before. Sometimes you might have to try to fake it till you make it. I think that's what you have been told before. So that's my comment. The other part that the question I want to ask is that you mentioned about the Sariputta having a lot of wisdom, but no insight. I mean, no psychic powers. So what I want to know is that what are the determinants for people who are wise, who are hard to have this and not that, to have psychic power but not so much wisdom, to have more wisdom, no psychic powers. What are the determinants of this?
Okay, so what determines whether an arahat is wise with no psychic powers, and what determines whether somebody has psychic powers but perhaps isn't quite as wise, for example? Yeah. Basically, it's just the inclination of the person beforehand. It's all the conditioning that comes from the past. And somebody like Venerable Mahamoggallana may have had an interest in psychic powers from maybe a past life, or from maybe from his youth or whatever. And because of that, he may always have inclined his mind in that direction. I think what very often happens is that those psychic powers are actually acquired before you become an arahant. Once you become an arahant, you are equanimous. You know, you couldn't really care less anymore whether you have psychic powers or not. But before that point, psychic powers may be interesting. Or maybe you think that you will help your students by reading their minds or something like that. So it's all about inclination, why you tend to, you know, basically the way you are conditioned from beforehand. That's basically all it is. The conditioning is in a certain way. But essentially, what you require to acquire any kind of psychic powers, and remember that arahantship itself is really a type of psychic power, because it's something most people don't have. It's some kind of special insight, understanding. The determinant for all of these things to arise is usually the fourth jhana is usually what is required. At that point, the mind is very, very stable and very even. So that is the requirement. And what happens from there will depend on your general inclination. I'm not sure if I can be more specific than that. I'm absolutely sure that's an unsatisfactory answer for you, but I think I'm not sure if I can be more specific, unfortunately. What is interesting, people often get very afraid that when somebody reads their mind, they get really, oh, this is scary. Because we all have thoughts we don't really feel proud of, right? But the thing is that, you know, if somebody can read your mind, especially if they're an arahant, there's nothing to be afraid of at all. Because even if they see your mind is completely polluted and dirty and dodgy and all this kind of things, the worst thing that can happen is that they will have compassion on you. And they will think, poor fellow, he's got all these problems in his life, you know. I should help him out or help her out. That's the worst thing that can happen. And that's pretty good. So sometimes it's actually good to have your mind read. If somebody knows what the problem is, they can help you out. So, anyone else want to ask a question?
Ajahn, there is one question from sisters here. If there is a very bad person and we show compassion towards them, but they actually taking advantage of us, what shall we do?
Okay. A This is a very common question. Well, the first thing, the most important thing is not, you know, you don't actually always have to have so much outward compassion. Compassion, the most important aspect of compassion is how you feel inside of yourself. So if you feel a sense of understanding of that person, you don't actually have to sort of, you know, go out and go out of your way to help them. If you, especially if you feel that it backfires and doesn't work, it's your mind state that is the most important thing. Yeah? And if your mind state is kind and good, it will come out in your actions anyway, but maybe in more subtle ways, you know, in subtle ways that you are just generally kind. And they will pick that up. They will understand that it's actually coming from compassion regardless. So if you find that it backfires too much to be outwardly compassionate, then just withhold it a little bit and just have it in your heart instead. And then don't, so that nobody actually takes advantage of you in that way. But over time, generally over time, if you really are a compassionate and kind person, people will generally come to accept that after a while. It's one of the things you also find in the sutta on the benefits of metta practice. One of the benefits that people tend to like you if you have metta. So if you want more friends, you want to be popular, that's the way to go. Anybody who doesn't want to be popular here? there you are. Are you happy with that answer? Does that make sense? Yeah?
Thank you, Ajahn. Anyone have one more question? Maybe? No one? Okay.